This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Well, I've said it before, and it's still true today. I love a good road trip. Earlier this year, I took one to Cleveland, Ohio, and got to see some amazing new technology at the Medical College of Case Western Reserve University.
This allows you to see the dark side of the moon ahead of time, understand what you might be seeing, and expect it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll see how virtual reality is saving lives today and training students to save more in the future. Then we'll head to northern New York, where several schools are practicing something called restorative justice. And we'll also spend an academic minute learning all about the dump, or the landfill, whichever floats your boat. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Mark Griswold has a lot of titles, or one big long one, depending on how you look at it. He's a professor in the Department of Radiology at Case Western Reserve University and University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio. He is also the director of MRI Research and director of Interactive Commons, Case Western Reserve University. I met Dr. Griswold on a recent road trip, and along with a group of other journalists, took a tour of his lab. He demonstrated some of the most cutting-edge teaching technology available, and he told us this.
By 2019, we will be in a building with no cadaver labs.
That's a pretty bold statement for one of the leading university medical programs in the country. What Dr. Griswold demonstrated for us was Case's holographic medical anatomy curriculum for the newly launched Microsoft HoloLens. It's a headset device that projects holograms into the real world. So you're not looking at a screen. The body you are studying is actually in front of you in the room. You can walk around it, examine it up and down, even look inside. It's expected to revolutionize the teaching of anatomy. After the demonstration, Dr. Griswold took questions from reporters. There are some medical students who think of a cadaver as their first real patient, and he was asked if students will be losing that bond.
Yes, but I think that we'll teach that in other ways. I think if the course is titled Anatomy, then the job is to learn anatomy. And I think that we'll learn that, we'll be able to teach that as well as we can do now in a digital form like this. I think we'll have to have other experiences where people learn that emotional contact with the patients and learn that reality of the cadaver. But that's not anatomy. And I think in terms of anatomy education, we're going to be able to do a great job with this.
Dr. Griswold also talked about the limitation of a traditional anatomy lab. Just to study certain parts of the foot, for example, can take hours of, for the lack of a better word, digging to get where you want to be.
Yes, so let me just talk about that for a second. So what you said is exactly right. We think that we can teach the actual anatomy much faster. That gives us room to teach all of that important emotional knowledge as well. So that's one component there. The one thing that where we really see a benefit of this over traditional cadavers is in the nervous system. So in the brain, for example, in a cadaver, there's nothing there. There's just mush. And you certainly don't have enough structure to pull out the fine things like the white matter fibers. This is really difficult. This is something that's almost trivial for us to do if we grab data from an MRI or a CT scan, and particularly the MRI data that we showed on stage. It takes us almost no time to get that in the HoloLens, and then it gives us this exquisite three-dimensional structure that you just can't get any other way. You can look at a book, and I've looked at books for 10 or 15 years, and even looked at 2D MRI images and wasn't able to understand it. But here, in this really true holographic view, you really understand the 3D structures. And again, just like what we were talking about in the foot or in the rest of the body, I can bring them in and out. I can see where they are with respect to each other. I can see how they connect into the cortex, how they connect down to the spinal cord. I don't know another way to do that.
And what about losing the hands-on experience of feeling the body?
I think that the tactile sense that you get in a cadaver lab is important. I think there's actual good scientific data that shows that it relates to memory, that being able to touch something relates to memory. So we're working on ways to replicate that. If you see the HoloLens, you can see that there is an interaction that happens with the data. Right now, it's, you know, we're not even really a year into this thing, so it's just kind of simple clicks and drags. But as we get further into this, that's going to get more and more advanced, and we're going to try to replicate that feeling. I guess for me, again, it's about anatomy. It's about getting the pieces all together, and so trying to to give them a sense of moving things in and out is the most important thing right now. I think doing it to the depth of replicating the feel of blood on your hands is really, really hard. But
the worlds of medicine and education intersect in many ways. One is change takes time, and getting professionals to accept that change can be difficult. We asked Dr. Griswold if there was any pushback by some in the medical community about teaching anatomy in this new way.
Some people, but I can tell you by the quantity of email in my inbox that there's a lot of people who want to do this. Going to a cadaver lab is not fun. So the smell is horrible. People actually have reactions to the formaldehyde that's there. We have students who can't do it because they can't tolerate it to be in the room. Did I bring up it's phenomenally expensive? And so we're going to be able to do this in an affordable way that I think will be absolutely viable.
Beyond cadaver labs, talk about how this can be used in, you know, other subjects, other educational settings.
So imagine one easy one is art history. So you could digitally restore a sculpture back to the way it looked hundreds of years ago, and maybe there was a sculpture that was a Greek sculpture that was originally in a garden. Well, we can replicate that garden and bring you back to that garden. And just imagine the cultural knowledge that then comes around with that sculpture. You can imagine doing this in engineering. You know, think about a complex jet engine, which is three-dimensional, different pressures and distributions of air throughout that engine. Well, now we can understand it in 3D. Or the stresses on a bridge, you can now see the bridge in three dimensions, or build an architectural model of your building and see it at scale before you actually build it. It gives you a level of understanding that you just can't get any other way.
What's next with this technology? Putting on gloves, being able to feel stuff?
Yes, that and many other things. Just being able to accurately see almost anything that you can imagine and being able to bring that into your home, being able to interact with it. This is making it real now.
By the way, you heard Dr. Griswold talk about the cost of running a cadaver lab. He says a new lab can cost up to $20 million to set up and another million a year to run and maintain. Each Microsoft HoloLens headset costs about $3,000, and that cost is expected to drop over the next few years. Among other things, Dr. Mark Griswold is a professor of radiology and director of MRI research at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And while Dr. Griswold was talking about advances for the future, there is technology available right now that is helping students and surgeons study the brain. The Oculus Rift 3D goggles give surgeons a virtual trip through brain tissues, vessels, and a 360-degree view around a brain tumor or aneurysm. It essentially helps them see the dark side of the moon before going in for brain surgery. I had a chance to try on this amazing piece of technology while touring the Case Medical Center at University Hospital in Cleveland. Dr. Warren Selman is the chairman of neurosurgery at University Hospital's Case Medical Center. I asked Dr. Selman exactly what it is I was looking through.
So you've been seeing surgical theaters, surgical navigation advanced platform. It's a device that allows us to really rehearse surgery as well as to navigate during surgery, which is critical for complex procedures.
Where has this device been developed?
The device was developed in Cleveland, Ohio by two former Israeli fighter pilots who decided to take what they've learned about flight simulation. They designed the flight simulator for the F-16 and transform that into how can we help surgeons navigate and rehearse, just the same as you would ask your pilot to use a simulator to rehearse the flight that they're going to take you on.
And pretty much you're putting on a virtual reality headset. This is not something you do during surgery, all right?
We do both. So we use the virtual reality headset to rehearse or pre-live the future ahead of the surgery with the patient's own anatomy. This isn't just a random simulation. This is the patient's own anatomy, but presented in a very graphic way that allows us to predict what might happen during surgery. And then we take that same information and couple it to a navigation system, which allows us to actually use the same information that we saw and make sure that we're linked up to what we're doing at the time of surgery.
And what does this show you that you couldn't see with your own eyes?
Well, a couple things. So first is we get to practice. We get to rehearse the surgery by seeing it in three dimensions, and then it allows us to actually get farther than we could at surgery. So in certain instances, we want to know what's on the backside of a tumor. We want to know what's on the backside of an aneurysm before we get there. At surgery, we can only see that at the time when we take out everything, and by then it may be too late to identify what's important on the other side. This allows you to see the dark side of the moon ahead of time, understand what you might be seeing, and expect it.
Is this something that a surgeon who is trained in brain surgery, of course, could just pick up and start using?
Absolutely. It'll only enhance their experience and, we think, make their outcomes better. So this is not only for training younger residents or medical students. This is for an experienced surgeon to be able to, what we call, pre-live the future, much like any good fighter pilot or any good airline pilot simulates with the best simulation they have. If a surgeon can do this ahead of time, we feel that they're going to improve their outcome because they'll essentially have practiced on the patient's own anatomy beforehand.
We're looking at a brain simulation. Is this being used, or could it be used for other parts of the body?
It can. The same technology. We chose brain surgery because it's rather complex, but there's many other complex surgeries, pediatric cardiothoracic, for instance, and many other places where we feel that if you could identify the anatomy better, know what to predict, that you'd be able to execute better.
When you first got into this game, you ever think you'd see something like this?
I never did. This was a game changer. I'm so thrilled that I've been able to work with these bright individuals who've taken what they've known about really dealing with flight simulation technology and applying it to the medical field.
Use your imagination. What's next?
I think what's next is really coupling different types of ways to present this. So we're dealing with virtual reality now. There's also augmented reality, which will allow us to do overlays of important structures right at the time we're looking at it as well. So there's an ever-expanding, I think, theater really for this in the future.
Dr. Warren Selman is the chairman of neurosurgery at University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio. My thanks to the Association of Healthcare Journalists for organizing the field trips for these last two pieces and for awarding me a fellowship to attend their conference this year. Still to come, what is restorative justice and how is it being practiced in schools? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Schools all over the country are considering an alternative form of disciplining students called restorative justice. For The Best of Our Knowledge, Paulina Phelps explains how this new system is being implemented in Northern New York's Capital Region.
Mike Brannigan, assistant principal of Queensbury Middle School, says the student body is changing.
We're noticing that the needs of students is really evolving, you know, with increased poverty rates, increased mental health diagnoses. Our student population is really changing in terms of their needs.
The school realized traditional methods of discipline were no longer as effective. In 2012, the school began looking for alternatives to traditional methods like in-school suspension and detention, which take the student out of the classroom. Restorative justice is a set of tools that can help students resolve issues without being asked to sit and put their heads down. Growing more popular in schools, restorative justice is also being implemented into youth detention centers, adult prisons, and other spaces serving the community. It is used as both a form of discipline and a means of communication. Tim Dawkins is principal of Oliver Wench Middle School in South Glens Falls, part of a school district that began implementing RJ in January 2016.
I think so often in schools, you know, in the 20th century model, we kind of have talked about punishment as consequences. And, you know, while in the moment that feels good or it feels appropriate. It really doesn't serve the people who were harmed.
Dawkins and other advocates believe that restorative justice is a model that can help solve problems that in-school suspension and other zero-tolerance policies may unintentionally create. The most common RJ exercise is a restorative circle. This brings together the student, a counselor who serves as an advocate for the student, as well as teachers and administrators. Dawkins says restorative justice techniques can be used in a variety of cases.
And it doesn't have to be something as even big as, you know, something was stolen out of a locker. We do restorative stuff even with, you know, interpersonal conflicts with kids. It may not necessarily be our job to fix the friendship, but it is in our best interest to make sure that, you know, the kids are emotionally healthy, because that trickles over into how they're able to perform in school.
Duke Fisher, a restorative justice facilitator in the Capital Region, echoes Dawkins.
We want to interrupt the behavior so that we're not just cycling through the same behavior until they get caught again, then we cycle through and then they get caught again.
Fisher's stepdaughter, Alexis, went through the RJ process at age 17. She says at the time, she was in an abusive relationship, isolating herself from her friends and family.
While I was still living at home, he had really ripped my family apart. So I moved in with him, and then I quit talking to my parents. I cut everybody out, friends, everything.
Seeking help, she was recommended by Fisher to participate in RJ circles at home and at school. Fisher talked to Alexis' school counselor to create a restorative circle involving Alexis, her brothers, and her friends.
My counselor got all of us together, and we talked, and I mean, it built a relationship that I didn't have before. I thought everybody around me hated me.
Alexis did not find the process of facing the people she hurt easy.
Having to sit with a bunch of people and apologize for screwing up, because I'm not one who likes to say that I did things wrong.
Alexis says she didn't want to apologize.
After hearing what they all said to me, I had to say I was sorry, because it was a mess.
The sanctions that are created are designed to repair the harm and reintegrate the student into their community. For example, in a case involving a teammate, instead of distancing the player from the team, RJ would find new ways to involve them. Again, Duke Fisher.
Maybe it's not less practices, maybe it's more practices, right? That's the idea. Maybe it's not just practicing with their team, but maybe now we use that person as part of their restorative sanction, they're going to work with a younger team.
Fisher says schools are integrating restorative justice techniques into their already existing disciplinary practices, including the traditional in-school suspension. Fisher argues that in-school suspension alone can be harmful to a student.
They come in, communication can be spotty, and often kids have sort of got their heads on their desk. They're either sleeping or just sitting quietly.
Fisher says this kind of discipline does not get students to be self-reflective. Instead, Fisher proposes restorative questions to help a student understand and resolve the issue.
Not just from the "you made a mistake," but also the idea of "what were you thinking at the time? What happened? What have you been thinking about since you came down here?"
But introducing RJ in schools requires time, funding, and resources. As a result, the integration process can take an especially long time in larger schools like Queensbury Middle School. With 400 staff members, Principal Mike Brannigan says progress is being made in small steps.
Having smaller pilots of the restorative practices, teachers will, you know, start incorporating some of the thoughts and beliefs of restorative practices into their classroom communities.
Not all educators are on board with restorative justice. One opponent is Dr. Marvin Marshall, an author and former high school assistant principal based in California. Marshall specializes in what he calls using authority without coercion. Marshall says restorative justice does not promote responsibility.
But instead, it's how can we coerce someone to right a wrong? As long as young people are coerced, they do not have ownership. And in order to change a person long term, the person must own the decision.
Marshall wants young people to make the right decision, not because they are told to, but because they know it is the right thing. Recognizing some of the challenges, including time and resources, Tim Dawkins in South Glens Falls hopes to create a marriage of philosophies between restorative justice and the traditional punitive system. This is also because many parents remain skeptical. Many grew up with a vastly different educational system. In a study on restorative justice in K-12 schools, The West Ed Justice and Prevention Research Center showed that 3 years after implementation, cumulative graduation rates rose 60% in RJ schools compared to just 7% in non-RJ schools. Alexis says RJ gave her closure upon graduating high school.
When I left, I got along with everybody again. I wasn't such an outcast. I didn't think everybody hated me anymore. I rebuilt my friendships that I thought I had lost.
That report from Paulina Phelps, a news intern at the Best of Our Knowledge's flagship station, WAMC, in Albany, New York. Well, we hope you're not feeling down in the dumps today, but if you are, maybe learning more about the dumps will help. Okay, probably not, but the dump is the topic of today's Academic Minute, so there's that.
How much do you know about landfills? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Joshua Reno, assistant professor of anthropology at Binghamton University, details how becoming more aware of where our trash goes might be a good way to start reducing it.
One of the biggest surprises I encountered researching the relationship between Americans and our garbage is the fact that landfills, the end of the line in the waste management chain, are such elaborate operations, and we depend on them for much more than we realize. My hands-on work that I pursued as part of my research provided me with a clear understanding of these facilities, one that runs counter to the notion that landfills are little more than dumps without much sophistication. In fact, they are far more complex. Landfills require the efforts of workers trained with a specific set of skills to keep things running smoothly, as well as on-site specialists for managerial tasks to satisfy regulations to minimize their environmental impact. In fact, the bigger problem is that many landfills are run so well, their workers are so good at concealing our waste from us, that we have become more wasteful as a result. While it's true that two generations of initiatives aimed at reducing the volume of trash in the garbage stream has had an impact, it's also amazing, and not in a good way, to witness the amount of usable items that end up at a landfill. People throw away TVs, computers, and other devices, sometimes still loaded with tons of personal information. While working on site as a paper picker at a mega landfill to better understand this phenomenon, I saw hundreds of items, often in perfectly good working order, discarded, sometimes by consumers, but more often from businesses. Furniture items, alcohol, and lots of food, still packaged and nowhere near the expiration date, were shipped off by the truckload. I heard stories about cases of snack cakes dumped off by the manufacturer, still boxed up and neatly sealed in plastic wrap. It's clear that many people don't think twice about what happens to the garbage they throw out. And, despite the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle, the foundation of the American dream is still built on the notion that it is acceptable to produce tons of waste.
That was Joshua Reno of Binghamton University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.